to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, April the 5th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a slight chance of storms. Winds will be from the south at 10 to 20 miles per hour. In Cedar Rapids, we'll see a high of 76 and 77 in Iowa City, falling to a low tonight of 56 in Cedar Rapids, 57 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 7:37 p.m., sunrise tomorrow morning at 6:40 a.m., for a total daylight period of 12 hours and 55 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, road projects for 2021 are underway in Cedar Rapids. A local option sales tax aids nearly 40 projects across the city. This is a story by Marissa Payne of the Gazette staff. Nearly 40 projects are planned for residential, collection, and main arterial roads in the city for this year's street construction season, which is kicking off as temperatures warm. Crews already are working on O Avenue Northwest and 12th Avenue Southeast. Paving for progress projects starting soon, according to the city, include segments on Oakland Road Northeast, Council Street Northeast, and Cottage Grove Avenue Southeast, which will entail complete reconstructions, new underground utilities, and pedestrian accommodations. More projects will be in the works in the coming weeks. Additional details on major projects are available at cityofcr.com/pavingforprogress. Paving for Progress, the city's 10-year street repair program funded by a voter-approved 1 cent local option sales tax, has resulted in an approximately $122 million investment in city streets since it took effect in 2014. Crews have improved more than 60 linear miles of roadway. The program has funded more than 200 projects, 70% of which have been residential and the rest of which have been arterial streets. The local option sales tax expires in 2024, unless voters opt to extend it when local officials decide to place the measure on the ballot. Revenue from Cedar Rapids residents and visitors who spend money in the city provides about $20 million for work on city streets each year. Paving for Progress projects slated for this year include 12th Avenue Southeast from 7th Street to 17th Street, 22nd Street Northeast and B Avenue intersection, 26th Avenue, 11th Street Southwest, from 27th Avenue to 12th Street, 30th Street Southeast from Pioneer Avenue to Mount Vernon Road, 32nd Street Northeast from Rosewood Court to Madison Street, 66th Avenue Southwest from Krendick Railroad to 8th Street, 6th Avenue Southeast from 16th to 17th Street, 6th Street Southwest from Wilson to 33rd Avenue, 8th Avenue Southeast from 14th to 16th Street, the asphalt portion, 9th Avenue Southwest from Cleveland Street to 8th Avenue, A Avenue Northeast from 23rd to 24th Street, B Avenue Northeast from 24th to 27th Street, B Avenue Northwest from 18th to 19th Street, Barkwood Drive Northeast, Blake Boulevard Southeast, from Forest Drive to Grand Avenue, the asphalt portions, Bowling Street Southwest, from 50th Avenue to Wilson Avenue, Birch Avenue Northwest, from 13th to 15th Street, C Street Southwest, from Bowling Street to Handley Drive, Chandler Street Southwest, and 20th Street Southwest Loop, Cleveland Street Southwest from 1st Avenue to 9th Avenue, Cottage Grove Avenue Southeast from 1st Avenue to Forest Drive, Council Street Northeast from Collins Road to Blair's Ferry Road, E Avenue Northwest from Jacqueline Drive to Shetland Drive, Edgewood Road Northwest from Ellis Road to the Bridge, Falcon Drive Northeast from Sally Drive to Glass Road, Greenfield Street Northeast from Oakwood to C Avenue, J Avenue Northwest from 11th Street to 13th Street, Jonathan Lane northwest from Olive to Orchard Drive, Kilimanjaro Drive northeast, L Street southwest from 28th Avenue to Diagonal Drive, O Avenue northwest from Edgewood Road to 20th Street, Oakland Road northeast from Center to Regent Street, Oakwood Avenue northeast from Fernwood Drive to North End, the east end of Arrowhead Lane northeast, Purple Drive northeast, Reynolds Avenue southwest from Cleveland to 21st Street, and Shetland Drive northwest from Midway Drive to E Avenue, Southgate Court southwest, Southridge Drive southwest, and Wiley Boulevard northwest from Cedar Crest Court to Rogers Road. Also from today's front page, tenure drops even without legislation to end it. A new Regents report shows numbers of all faculty down. This is a story by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette staff. The Gazette proposals to eliminate tenure across Iowa's public universities might be dead for this legislative session, but that doesn't mean the esteemed academic appointment is alive and well across the state's institutions. A new Board of Regents report made public last week shows the combined tally of tenured and tenure-track professors at the University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa is dropping. Additionally, the Regent universities this year are proposing fewer promotions with or without tenure, at 237, down from last year's 277, and the lowest since 2016. Although the University of Iowa is reporting fewer tenured and tenure-track faculty and proposing fewer promotions with tenure than last year, it's proposing more promotions without tenure, likely expanding that group's swelling majority among faculty. The University of Iowa's 1,853 non-tenure-track faculty now account for 56% of its 3,316 faculty total, and that total tally is falling, not just at the UI, but at ISU and UNI, too, in this pandemic-plagued year that has crunched budgets and further shrunk enrollment. Faculty totals for the campuses combined fell 4% from last year, from 6,028 to 5,815, the lowest since 2014-15, and the first time the total has been below its prior year in a decade. UI and ISU faculty totals dropped 3% this year from last. UNI lost 8% of its total. The campuses shaved those numbers largely from the non-tenure track pool of employees. University of Iowa's non-tenure track total dropped 4%, while its tenure and tenure track lost 1%. ISU's non-tenure loss was 4%, compared with its 2% drop in tenure and tenure track. UNI lost 15% of non-tenure track employees, compared with 5% of tenure and tenure track. Those numbers hit at the heart of the debate for both sides, with non-tenure track employees feeling expendable and insecure, and tenure opponents pointing to the reality that tenured faculty are harder to dismiss. Tenure, by the board's definition, is an employment status granting heightened aspects of job security in order to create and maintain an atmosphere for the free exchange of ideas and inquiry necessary for educating Iowa students and advancing knowledge in democracy. Achieving tenure involves a rigorous 6-year probation period during which candidates undergo comprehensive internal and external peer reviews. Typically, tenure comes with higher pay and issue during tight budget times. But tenured faculty also offer experience, prestige, and research opportunities that students seek out in shopping for colleges, circling back to the importance of strong student recruiting and enrollment in a hyper-competitive higher education landscape. Nonetheless, tenured professors can be let go for just cause, financial exigency, or eliminated programming. They also can face a range of disciplinary actions. Despite the value tenure holds for universities' capacity to recruit and retain top faculty, Republican state lawmakers this session worried about liberal bias and free speech suppression of conservative ideas, ran a pair of bills in the Senate and House looking to strip the public campus's ability to offer tenure. Those bills died last week. The debate didn't. The bill was intended to start a discussion, which it certainly did. Representative Steve Holt, Republican of Denison, said of the measure. In a February committee debate, Representative Ken Rosenboom, Republican of Oskaloosa, rebuffed concerns that ending the academic appointment could hurt the entire state and its economy. He and peers questioned the authenticity of tenure review. Some things are more important than dollars and cents, and I think freedom of speech and freedom of expression are those things, Rosenboom said, referencing First Amendment controversies this academic year at the universities. Majority Republican lawmakers, with a series of bills, including the ones to end tenure, rebuked recent events on Iowa's public universities, including the University of Iowa College of Dentistry's handling of a conservative student who opposed its condemnation of a diversity training ban and an ISU professor's syllabus banning conservative-leaning viewpoints. Although the Board of Regents has maintained strong opposition to bills seeking to end tenure, it has acknowledged First Amendment shortcomings and said it has taken steps to correct them. In November, Board President Mike Richards condemned preventing another person or group's opinion from being expressed or threatening those opinions with possible repercussions, a reference to issues that had or were unfolding across the campuses. This is not who we are, Richards said, and it is not right. The Regents since have established a free speech committee to update policies and review free speech complaints. And from today's Iowa Today section, a woman has died in a field fire near Marion. A woman tending to a ditch fire near Marion became engulfed in flames and died Sunday afternoon when the blaze grew out of control, authorities said. The Linn County Sheriff's Office received a 911 call at 3:14 p.m. reporting the fire in the 3,000 block of Gilmore Road near the Tuma Soccer Complex north of Marion. Emergency personnel discovered the woman who had been trying to tend the fire and was on the ground, overcome by smoke and flames. The woman, whose name was not released, died at the scene, the sheriff's office said. The state fire marshal's office is assisting with the investigation. According to the Iowa Department of Public Safety, no current bans on open burning had been reported to it on Sunday in either Linn or Johnson counties. Nonetheless, the National Weather Service cautioned that wind gusts on Sunday and again Monday made open burning risky. Warm temperatures, low relative humidity, and south winds gusting to around 25 miles per hour will result in a very high risk for grass fires this afternoon north of Interstate 80, the Weather Service said Sunday, noting that the same danger is forecast for today. Any fire that develops could quickly get out of control. Outdoor burning is strongly discouraged. And two are arrested after shots fired near a Cedar Rapids bar. Police arrested two Cedar Rapids men early Sunday following a fight outside a downtown bar and after a gunshot was heard nearby. At 12:58 a.m., officers were dispatched to Hazard County American Saloon at 402 2nd Avenue Southeast for a report of two people fighting outside, one of whom was armed with a handgun. When officers arrived, they did not find anyone fighting, but heard a gunshot from near 2nd Avenue and 3rd Street Southeast, according to a news release. Officers were told the man who fired the gun was seen getting into a white pickup in the 400 block of 3rd Avenue Southeast. Police stopped a white 2011 Ford F-150. Based on their investigation and a recovery of a 9mm handgun in the pickup, a passenger in the vehicle, 27-year-old Devonier R. Jackson, was identified as the one who fired the gun, police said. He was arrested on suspicion of reckless use of a firearm, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, possession of a firearm while intoxicated, and marijuana possession. He also had a warrant through the Webster County Sheriff's Office for a failure to pay child support. According to the criminal complaint, Jackson had pressed the handgun against the leg of another man to intimidate him and fired the gun into the air while other people were present. The driver of the pickup, 29-year-old Daniel R. Turnus of Cedar Rapids, was arrested on suspicion of operating while intoxicated. Jackson and Turnus were taken to the Linn County Jail. Turning to today's opinion page, we have a guest column by Margaret Sullivan, who is a Washington Post media columnist, and her piece is entitled, "The Problem with Cheering for the Dominion Lawsuit." When Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani became fixtures on right-wing media with their outlandish election conspiracy theories, their disinformation was more than just false. It was harmful. Repeated appearances by those Donald Trump allies on Fox News, Newsmax, and One America News helped convince millions of Americans that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. Some who ingested the lies ended up storming the U.S. Capitol, where lives were lost or ruined on January 6. Even now, a substantial chunk of the country refuses to accept the Biden presidency as legitimate. Given that harm, it's easy to understand why defenders of democracy might be cheering the billion-dollar lawsuits filed against Fox by two voting technology companies, Smartmatic and Dominion Voting Systems. The two companies are seeking damages of more than $4 billion from Fox, claiming that their corporate reputations and employees' well-being were deeply harmed by lies that their equipment was used to manipulate the vote. In some ways, it's a relief to see someone hold Fox to account, especially since nothing else seems able to restrain right-wing media outlets from spreading disinformation. The suits, along with signals that more are coming, have had an apparent effect. Fox Business abruptly ended Lou Dobbs' show without saying why. Unusual corrective segments have aired. The election lie story has simmered down somewhat. But for those who care about the reality-based news media, there's a downside, and nobody is thinking about that more intently than the people at a small investigative California newsroom called Reveal, which is run by the nonprofit Center for Investigative Reporting. These defamation suits can decimate the legitimate press, said D. Victoria Baranetsky, general counsel at Reveal. She told me in an interview last week that Reveal could have been driven out of business altogether by the costs associated with a suit filed in 2016 by the subjects of one investigation, but that significant pro bono help from two large law firms rescued them from that fate. Reveal was hit by a defamation case after its two-year investigation tied to a charity, Planet Aid, to a cult, and raised serious questions about Planet Aid's spending. It's the kind of watchdog work that investigative journalism is supposed to do. But Planet Aid sued for $25 million, twice the annual budget of the Center for Investigative Reporting. A judge finally threw the case against Reveal out of court in March, but it took 4 years and millions of dollars to make that happen. And, in its wake, the defamation lawsuit playbook remains. It's an existential threat for some media companies. Other news organizations might look at this lawsuit and decide that reporting on powerful or deep-pocketed organizations isn't worth the risk, Baranetsky wrote in an op-ed in the Columbia Journalism Review, co-written with Alexandria Gutierrez, a First Amendment fellow at the Center for Investigative Reporting. They added this caution: for every Smartmatic case lauded as a promising defense against disinformation, there are also situations like ours. It's happening in an atmosphere in which long-standing media rights are under siege in troubling ways. Just weeks ago, Federal Appeals Court Judge Lawrence Silberman sent chills down the spines of free press advocates when he issued a harsh dissenting opinion in a defamation case decided by the D.C. Circuit. Silberman, one of the most prominent and influential conservative judges in the country, attacked Times v. Sullivan, the 1964 case that solidified press freedom in the United States, by establishing a high standard for public officials to sue over libel and defamation. In it, the Supreme Court said that even if a news report about a public figure was false, it couldn't be the basis for a libel judgment unless it showed reckless disregard for the truth. The ruling reflects the principle that news organizations, staffed by fallible humans, will sometimes get things wrong and must be allowed to do their jobs with some protections from punishment. These long-standing protections are what Trump railed against when he promised to open up libel laws and get lots of money from media companies for stories he didn't like. Baranetsky, reveals counsel, told me that media companies are especially wary right now, worried about conservative judges who may echo Silberman's views about the media, worried about the blueprint all too available for suing journalists into extinction. There's a high-wire balancing act going on, she said. If defamation suits, even valid ones, are successful, long-standing First Amendment protections could be weakened. Aggrieved subjects of news stories, especially those with deep pockets, may be encouraged to go after media companies of all kinds, not just hyper-partisan ones. It would be comforting to think that defamation suits won't ward off good journalism while seeking to punish their spreading of irresponsible lies, but that's far from a sure thing. And that piece by Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post. Turning to today's community letters, there are two today. The first is opposing the federal COVID-19 relief bill was hypocritical. This is by Karen Franklin of Iowa City. The latest stimulus bill that passed Congress was done without any Republican support. This bill provides financial help to individuals, businesses, states, and local governments. It addresses issues of the pandemic, including vaccines, access to health care, and attempts to get the economy back on its feet. Yet current Republicans, including those in our own legislature, argue that it's too expensive, it's not targeted, and now that it takes away local control. This last point is particularly ironic for Iowa's current legislature. The part that allocates money to state and local governments indicates that this money cannot be used to enable state and local governments to reduce taxes. I think this is called targeting, because if you need this money to support your government, how does it make sense that you would take the federal money and then cut taxes? If state coffers and projected revenues enable the reduction in taxes, that state does not need money from the federal government. So states that want to cut taxes, go ahead. Just don't take any of this stimulus money because you obviously don't need it. And by the way, not taking the money reduces the total amount of federal money that is actually spent, and you have reduced the federal deficit that you are now so worried about. So is your position a little hypocritical? Just opposition to something that was done by a Democratic administration? Or is there a logical theory in there that I'm missing? and that letter by Karen Franklin of Iowa City. The next letter is entitled GOP Opposes the Common Good, unlike 1935 and 1965. And this letter is by Gary Sanders, also of Iowa City. It is worth noting that toward the end of their long attack on the recently passed American Rescue Plan Act in the March 21 Gazette, guest columnists John Hendrickson and Pete Sepp accused President Joe Biden of expanding government, especially federal power, and following in the footsteps of both Franklin D. Roosevelt and President Lyndon Johnson. Roosevelt was responsible for getting Social Security passed in 1935, and Johnson was responsible for getting Medicare passed in 1965. Both of these historic legislative acts were accused of being socialist and an overreach by the federal government. Both passed Congress overwhelmingly, as Republicans in those eras joined Democrats to pass legislation that they deemed necessary for the common good. Voting for the Social Security Act in 1935 were 81 Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives and 16 in the Senate. Voting for the Medicare Act in 1965 were 70 Republicans in the U.S. House and 13 in the Senate. Someday, the 2021 American Rescue Plan Act will be considered as essential as Social Security and Medicare. It is unfortunate that today, unlike 1935 and 1965, we do not have Republicans who will vote for the common good and join Democrats in passing needed legislation, even if it expands government and especially federal power. And this letter by Gary Sanders of Iowa City. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, April the 5th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, from Center Point, James Dwayne Brinkerhoff passed away on Friday, April the 2nd. And I don't see any further information about Mr. Brinkerhoff. From Iowa City, Stephen A. Belger, age 59, a longtime resident of Iowa City, died suddenly Saturday, March the 27th, at his home near Isabella, Minnesota. Private family services have been held with burial at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City near his parents' grave. And from Hills, Donald Joseph Draker, age 85, died on Thursday, April the 1st, at his home. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 6th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Hills, where a rosary will be held at 7 p.m. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 7th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Hills. Burial will follow at St. Stanislaus Cemetery in rural Hills. From Iowa City, Dorothy, also known as Dozy Seamoth, age 87, died peacefully on Friday, April the 2nd, at the Crestview Care Center in West Branch. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, April 7th, at the Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service. Family and friends may gather after 10:30 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. From Kyoto, Norma, also known as Toots Conrad, age 86, died Friday, April the 2nd, at the Keokuk County Health Center in Sigourney. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Kyoto is caring for Toots and her family. And from Keystone, Larry Warren Feller, age 70, passed away on Friday, April the 2nd, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 10:30 a.m. until time of funeral service at 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 6th, at the Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Ingalls Chapel in Grundy Center. Burial will follow at Rose Hill Cemetery in Grundy Center. From Morley, Dana Holland, age 61, died April the 1st at his home following a long illness. Due to the current health pandemic, a celebration of his life will be held at a later date. From Vinton, George Dean Rice, age 74, passed away on Saturday, April the 3rd, at Unity Point Marshalltown Health Medical Center. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April the 7th, at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church Fellowship Hall in Van Horn. The interment will be held at the Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton with graveside military rites. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the St. Andrew's Sanctuary and from 9:30 a.m. until service time Wednesday in Fellowship Hall. From Urbana, Charlotte J. Eldred, age 79, died Friday, April the 2nd. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, April 6th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. A private funeral mass will be held. Burial will take place at St. Mary's Cemetery in Spencer's Grove, Iowa. And from Riverside, Patrick William Forenash, age 67, passed away unexpectedly on April the 1st. No services are planned, but donations can be directed to Paws and More Animals Shelter at 1004 West Madison Street in Washington. From Williamsburg, Gerald Friedrich Moss. Mr. Moss has passed away, and the Celebration of Life graveside will be at 11 a.m. Monday, April the 5th, at Cedar Memorial Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until service time at the cemetery. And in other death notices, Maureen Clavins of Cedar Rapids, age 83, died Sunday, April the 4th. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Also from Cedar Rapids, Carol B. Powell, age 106, died Friday, April the 2nd. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Iowa City, Elva, also known as Babe Phipps, age 99, died Friday, April the 2nd. The Lansing Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Iowa City is assisting the family. And from Solon, Barry Glick, age 73, died Saturday, April the 3rd. The Fry Funeral Home in Tipton is assisting the family. And from Tama, April L. Jefferson, age 42, died Saturday, April the 3rd. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, Toledo, is assisting the family. Finally, from Williamsburg, Jeff Allen Albaugh, age 62, died Saturday, April the 3rd. The Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is assisting the family. And from our sports page today, we have a piece entitled 2021 Boys and Girls Golf, Individuals and Teams to Watch. Under the girls' individuals, it's Kiki Bruner of Washington, a senior who is two-time state participant, finished fourth in the 2019 3A state meet and 16th in 2018, and posted a 40.58 combined adjusted average and led 3A with 39.209 hole average. And Tatum DuPoit at Linmar, who's a senior, first team All-MVC and All-Metro golfer. Caitlin Hotchkiss, a Cedar Rapids Xavier senior, who finished 20th at the 2019 3A state meet, an honorable mention and All-MVC, the 2020 Pribble champion. Neely Morris, Iowa City Liberty, also a senior, a first-team All-MVC performer. Anna Nakos, of Washington, Iowa, a senior, a two-time state meet participant. Emma Sword, a Cedar Rapids, Washington senior, two-time state qualifier. And Maddie Stryker, Edgewood Colesburg senior, who placed fifth at the 2019 1A state meet and led all 1A sophomores in 2019. Girls' teams include Cedar Rapids, Washington. The Warriors have not been to the state golf meet since 2002, but this could be the season to end the hiatus. And from Washington, Iowa, the Demons have been one of the best programs, regardless of class. Before the canceled season, the Demons had a string of successful state meet performances. And Linmar, the Lions have been a strong program under Chris James. Tatum DuPoit will provide a low score and lead the way. Abby Hofel will be a strong support. Linmar has a couple more that contribute, with some younger golfers having potential to solidify the lineup. The team may progress with the season. And Western Dubuque, The Bobcats have balance and experience. All of the players have played competitively in the past. And here are the boys' individuals. Dylan Countryman of West Branch, a junior, who placed second at the Class 2A state meet in 2019. Ethan Kupka, an HLV senior, who posted 43.92 combined adjusted average. Justin Recker from Monticello, a senior, shot 42.25 per nine holes, averaged 82.74 per round. And Caleb Sexton, a West Branch senior, tied for eighth at 2A state meet in 2019. Lucas Tepoel, from Solon, a senior, who finished 43.26 combined adjusted average. And Isaac Zertzman, a Maquoketa Valley senior, tied for 16th at the 1A state meet. And the boys' teams include Benton Community. Few teams have been as consistent as the Bobcats in recent years. And Monticello. The Panthers have some very good golfers returning. West Branch, the Bears, finished second at the weather-shortened 2019 2A state meet. They returned three key members of that squad. And West Delaware, the Hawks have the same dilemma as other teams. The lack of experience in competition will be a huge question mark. But Elias Tibbett has had past success as a contributor and will have to be the anchor for the team. And here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, Marriage is Not for Man with Divorce in His Past. Dear Abby, I'm a single mom. I have a man in my life who I have been with for almost 4 years. He went through a bad divorce during the time we got together. And any time I try to mention marriage in the future, he gets upset. I'm unsure what to do or how to respond anymore. I know my kids aren't his, so he owes us nothing, but I need more stability and the assurance that if something were to happen to him, we would be okay. I'm 35 and have never had the chance to get married, only to find out that he never wants to get married. So what do I do? Signed, Mystified in Minnesota. Abby responds, Dear Mystified, talk to your significant other. Keep the conversation calm and tell him what you wrote to me. Add to it that after 4 years, he should know by now what your needs are and that he can trust you. But you need stability for your kids' sakes and your own. And if he can't bring himself to make another trip to the altar, a trip to a lawyer's office might yield an agreement that meets your needs and his. However, if he refuses to consider it, then what you must do is to move on. Also, a note from the COVID front, an article by John McLaughlin of the Gazette staff entitled, Over 636,000 Iowans Complete COVID-19 Shots. A day before COVID-19 vaccine eligibility opens broadly throughout Iowa, the state reported Sunday that 636,513 Iowans have been fully vaccinated, over 48,000 of them in Linn County and nearly 38,000 in Johnson County. Starting today, anyone over 16 is eligible to schedule an appointment, not only the priority groups that started getting doses on December 14. While the supply of vaccines is increasing, though, public health officials caution that demand still far outweighs supply, and about three-fourths of the state's age 16 and up population has yet to be fully inoculated. In Linn County, public health data show that 48,001 people have been fully vaccinated as of Sunday. That's about 26.60% of the county's 16 and up population. In Johnson County, 37,963 people were fully vaccinated as of Sunday. That's about 30.54% of the county's 16 and up population. The state reported 431 new COVID-19 cases in the 24-hour period that ended at 11 a.m. Sunday. That brings the total number of cases in Iowa so far to 353,242. Of those, Linn County added 26 cases, for a total of 19,976. Johnson County added 21 cases, for a total of 13,655. Statewide, for those up to age 17, 73 new cases were added in the period, for a total of 40,787. Public health data reported only minor fluctuations in the 24-hour period in patients being treated in Iowa hospitals for the disease. The number of patients inched up from 200 to 201, but those in intensive care rose from 44 to 47, and those using ventilators to breathe increased from 20 to 23. No additional COVID-19 deaths were confirmed in the 24-hour period. The total number of Iowans who have died as a result of the infection stood Sunday at 5,822. From today's community page, we have an article entitled Expanding Horizons, an article by Diana Nolan of the Gazette staff. Mark and Leslie Nolte of Iowa City are transforming the former home of Riverside Theater at 213 North Gilbert Street into the James Theater. By the start of the next school year, they hope to throw open the doors to a new community performing arts center, as well as a performance and workshop site for the Iowa Conservatory, a performing arts high school being incubated at Nolte Academy in Coralville. The theater is a separate entity from Nolte Academy, said Leslie Nolte, 44, who will serve as the theater's artistic director, deeming her husband, 45, the executive director, since he'll handle the business aspects. In announcing their plan, they said they intend to operate the venue as a benefit corporation, a hybrid between a business and a nonprofit, if the Iowa legislature formally approves recognizing this legal structure. According to bcorporation.net, certified B corporations are a new kind of business that balances purpose and profit. They are legally required to consider the impact of their decisions on their workers, customers, suppliers, community, and the environment. The couple will be renting the building from the Gilpin family, which previously rented it to Riverside Theater from 1990 to 2020, when Riverside moved to virtual programming during the COVID-19 pandemic. That professional troupe, formed in 1981, is developing a new home in the pedestrian mall district's Crescent Block downtown. All of these changes are happening in stages. The Noltes received the building keys last week and are talking with architects about ways to enlarge and enhance the stage, dressing rooms, restrooms, lobby, and seating, as well as increase accessibility for audiences and performers with disabilities, and install a new HVAC system. Permission to renovate is part of the lease, Leslie Nolte said. It's a pretty big overhaul, she noted. We're bringing it into 2021. I'm excited. The initial renovation budget is $250,000, and the couple will be rolling out a fundraising 10-show countdown this summer, leading to a gala opening in the early fall. They're also exploring some other fundraising streams. Business advertising with selling the seats is on the table, Leslie Nolte said. We're looking at a couple different models. Nothing is 100% right now. We're in the creation phase. We just know we're doing it. We will probably spend the next 30 days in the space finalizing the plans, and Build to Suit is doing our remodel, and they'll get started as soon as we sign off on everything. The theater is named for Leslie Nolte's father, James Bartnick of Arlington Heights, Illinois. He's still alive, she quickly added. I want to honor him while he's still here. He has been a huge supporter from the very beginning of Nolte Academy, when we first started into the art scene here in Johnson County. He was financially a support for me to make it a go, and he's been my shoulder for business advice through all the ups and downs through the last 20 years. I think the name is cool, she added. I did not name any of my children after him, and that's always been a little point of contention. So he gets a theater. While theater is a part of the venue's name, she anticipates just calling it the James. I'd like the boundaries of theater to stay a little loose in regard to workshop space, she said. And so artists or creators or innovators think this is a place for them. We hope it's for everybody. It will provide space for Nolte Academy students and teachers who want to create work outside of their recitals and annual Nutcracker performances. Right now, the studios at the Coralville Instructional Facility are filled all the time, so the James will allow them to branch out. But that will take up just a portion of the theater's calendar, leaving plenty of dates to offer rental space for small groups, singer-songwriters, dancers, and other performers who have a hard time finding such sites. We all know the theater companies that get volunteer space from church basements and dance companies that never get off the ground because real estate is expensive, Leslie Nolte said. If you're a brand new creator of any kind, you have to create the work before you can make the money to pay for the work, and it's such a backward model. Having a theater space that's supported by what we've done here already for 20 years, I just want to see incubation of work being made. Incubate it. Workshop it. I feel like it could be anything from a teenager's book of poetry to installation arts, to a full day of performance art, to a 2 or 3 person modern dance company. Seating will be about 130. With a house our size, I think our niche is just really the creation of new work, and then also a home theater for the homework that we want to create as our performing arts high school and dance academy and theater arts schools. She's currently using Nolte Academy to incubate Iowa Conservatory, an in-person intensive arts education for students ages 11 to 19. A positive from the pandemic has been the Iowa City School District's online program. What that now allows us to do is to have a day program for our arts while still staying within the Iowa City School District for the academics, she said. Her goal is to offer the kind of arts educational programming that high school students aiming for a professional career typically have to leave Iowa to find. She also sees the James as a new option for some of the arts that played at the mill before it closed last summer, and she's working with her 16-year-old daughter Zoe about hosting Tuesday Teen Night, offering an arts open mic type of experience. I remember being an artist in high school, and unless it was an event that my high school put on, there was nowhere for me to really create and perform, Leslie Nolte said. The James Theater will act a little bit like a community center for the arts if I reach my goal. The stage size will be perfect for dance performances and singer-songwriter shows, she noted. What's lovely is that you can outgrow us. You can start in a rented or borrowed basement or garage, and when you outgrow us, there's the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts, with just over 400 seats. When you outgrow them, you've got the Englert, with just over 700 seats. And when you outgrow them, you've got Hancher, she said. We feel happily in the little creation phase at the bottom of the pool. They're also exploring the possibility of expanding the downtown event footprint by serving as a satellite performance space for festivals like Mission Creek. I'm super excited for the conversations and the possibilities, she said. And here are a few Eastern Iowa briefs. First from Cedar Rapids, a luggage drive is to help foster care children. Iowa BIG students are partnering with Four Oaks to host a luggage drive for foster care children in the Cedar Rapids area. Eventually, the students will be hosting a pop-up shop where the children can come and pick out an item of luggage that they can call their own. The students will be accepting donations through April 29. The donations can be brought to Iowa BIG at the Geonetric Building at 415 12th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. There also will be donation sites at 3 McGrath Auto Dealerships, Chevyland at 1651st Street 51st Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids, Ford at 1040 North Center Point Road in Hiawatha, and Jeep at 4610 Center Point Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. A drop box at Dan and Debbie's Creamery in Ely at 1600 Main Street, and a drop box at Rawlalicious in Newbo at 1101 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Along with donations of gently used luggage, the Iowa BIG students also have an Amazon wish list where you can buy new items to be donated. When you buy from the wish list, it will be sent directly to Iowa BIG for our students to store. The wish list can be found on the website that the students have created at luggage.iowabig.org/index.php/foster-care-luggage-drive. The students of Iowa BIG decided on this project after being informed that most foster care children have to carry around their belongings from house to house in trash bags. Any donations are greatly appreciated. And Iowa City community seeks diaper donations. April showers bring May flowers, and all during April, community is asking for help buying diapers for their month-long baby shower. Every month, around 650 families request diapers from Community Crisis Services and Food Bank in Iowa City. Currently, they are unable to guarantee that they can meet this need and have diapers in stock when families visit the Pepperwood Food Pantry. Community is able to keep food on the shelves because it purchases bulk food at a deep discount and receives donations from organizations like Table to Table, and is able to make their dollars stretch. $1 buys 5 pounds of food. Diapers are different. They don't expire, and they're in high demand. So community pays the same for diapers as everyone else, and they are expensive. Because of this, community relies heavily on diaper drives and donations to supply diapers for its food pantry families year-round. You can help by making a financial donation at builtbycommunity.org/shower. Set up a monthly Amazon or Target subscription delivery of diapers directly to community, or purchase diapers and drop them off at community at 1121 South Gilbert Court. All diaper sizes are needed, but sizes 5 and 6 are most in demand. Go to builtbycommunity.org donations for more information on donations and drives. And apply for rent and mortgage assistance. Residents can now apply for rent, utilities, and mortgage assistance programs through the Iowa Finance Authority. Two programs aimed at helping Iowans through COVID-19-related financial hardships are now open for applications. The Iowa Rent and Utility Assistance Program, as well as the Iowa Homeowner Foreclosure Prevention Program. The Iowa Rent and Utility Assistance Program will provide eligible COVID-19-impacted renters with rent and/or utility assistance for a total of up to 12 months. General eligibility requirements require that applicants are current renters earning no more than 80% of their county's area median income, that one or more individuals in the household must have either qualified for unemployment benefits or have experienced a documented financial hardship as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that the resident must be able to demonstrate a risk of experiencing homelessness or housing instability, which may include a past due utility or rent notice or eviction notice. The Iowa Homeowner Foreclosure Prevention Program provides eligible COVID-19 impacted homeowners at imminent risk of foreclosure with mortgage assistance for up to 4 months, with a maximum assistance of $3,600 per household. The short-term program will be available until funds are exhausted or a new federal program is launched. To learn more about both programs, visit iowahousingrecovery.com. And our pet of the week is Max. Max is a 9-year-old neutered male Siamese cat available for adoption at the Cedar Valley Humane Society at 7411 Mount Vernon Road, Southeast. Max is looking for his retirement home and would do best in a home without other pets. He loves lying in laps, snuggling, and catnip, and is declawed on all four paws. The shelter is open by appointment only. Call 319-362-6288 for more information. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, April the 5th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time, and thank you for the listening.